in the morning, but then gradually clearing away. Sunday spells and showers for the afternoon, highs of around about 7 degrees or so. And for Scotland, well, here mostly it's a mixture of sunny spells and showers. You'll have that persistent rain in the south, but that gradually creeps north during the course of the evening. And we're looking at a high on the day here of around 7 degrees. Mairead, that's the forecast.
Lovely. Thank you very much indeed, Philip. Philip Avery there at the BBC Weather Centre. Now, our book of the week, Man Belong, Mrs. Queen by Matthew Baylis. As he reaches the moment of departing from the island of Tanna, the author looks back at what he learned or failed to learn about their customs. He reflects on their metaphorical version of a road as a bond or an alliance, and wonders if their bizarre practice of worshipping Prince Philip wasn't in fact just an act of realpolitik and not a religion at all. The reader is Philip Franks.
At the airport, something was blocking the runway, so we had to wait. Nako and Cal sat grimly on the grass beside me, muttering in their mother tongue, treating me to monosyllables. I told them that they didn't need to wait, but Cal had said rather disarmingly that they liked to see the planes take off. Nako just ignored me. Finally, the runway was cleared, and a man in an improbably elaborate uniform instructed us all to line up inside. Suddenly, Carl grabbed me, squeezing the breath from my bones. I expected the second act to follow soon, the kick to the shins, the jab to the solar plexus. He pushed me away from him, both hands upon my shoulders. "I like you," he announced, glaring all the while. "Please come again. Thank you." His stern moustache suddenly curled into a grin as he pumped my hand. I grinned back as Carl reached in his pocket and produced a little package, wrapped in newspaper. "I hope it's not kaffa," I said, continuing the wind-up, "because, you know, I really don't like that stuff." I made a face. Carl's smile vanished. "It's not kaffa. It's our island tobacco." He handed me the package. I blushed. "Thank you, Carl," I said feebly, sheepishly, to his departing back. I couldn't help stuffing things up, it seemed, even unto the very last minutes. Had my whole visit been like that last moment, I wondered? A clumsy clown of a bloke blundering into that frail, delicate mountain society, crashing its taboos and shaking it with my questions and my assumptions. Or had I been used by them? A handy dupe for their never-ending politicking. A tool in both senses of the word. Both were probably true. Just as I was about to leave the airport building and walk out onto the sunlit tarmac, I felt a tap on my shoulder and turned round to see Nako. He looked sheepishly down to the rubber tips of his newly acquired deck shoes, an awkward air about him that urged me suddenly and forcefully to forgive everything. He'd done a lot for me, after all, this short, battered little man, and I was wrong to leave him without thanks. What, in the end, had he really done wrong? Tell the odd fib? Try to big himself up, get back in his dad's good books? Had it prevented me from learning what I'd come here to learn? "Thank you for everything, Nako." He looked up. "Your watch," he said, fixing me with a bloodshot eye. "You said I could have your watch." Numbly, I started to take it off. "Also that aftershave potion," he added. Later, as if he'd now retreated to a specimen under a magnifying glass, I watched him through the tiny window of the aeroplane. His father's final words had been an attack on greed. Nako's final words to me had been, just like all his others, concerned, primarily, with Nako. And in their separate ways, the two crystallized what it meant to be Man Tanna, to deplore greed, and at the same time fight a lifelong fight for the honours due a big man, to seek harmony and balance, and still ensure that it's your village which gets the road, the truck, the water tap, and the tourists. Perhaps we were just as contradictory. In the name of fairness and tolerance, we poured scorn on Philip, not seeming to see that we weren't fair to him, or to the Tannese. Chief Jack Neva died in 2010, but the movement continues, now headed by his grandson, Siko Nathawan. It seems to have drifted, or perhaps been concertedly driven, towards a more extrovert kind of religious expression. There are now shrines in the village. A Union Jack flies, and the villagers dance on the Duke of Edinburgh's birthday. They may be doing this to compete with the symbols and ceremonies of their neighbours. They may also have realised that if filmmakers and journalists are going to keep coming, then they need something concrete to film and photograph. And it works. The newsmen still come, and over time the coverage has become gentler, although that has more to do with etiquette than understanding. Newspaper descriptions of Chief Jack Neaver accentuated his age, the fact that he was never entirely sure about it, and the isolation of his settlement. They seemed blind to his interest in world affairs, or his chiefly bearing, or the love his village bore for him. No article mentions how full and rich and free their lives are, how much spare time they have for simple pleasures. That waiting for Prince Philip is not the irksome, painful process of longing we would make it, but something they simply slot into their daily experience. When I asked him about cargo, the chief had said that, of course, Prince Philip would bring gifts because he was a rich man. But that wasn't the point. Everyone who has visited the Philippists has somehow missed the point, just as I fear I did, with my blundering around after shrines and snooping on imaginary myth-stealers. And what was the point? Perhaps it's this, that after 200 years of bewildering contact with whites, and amid the melee of pre-independence politics, the people of Yochanan needed some road, symbolic and real, towards an outside power. In 1966, the British government representative Alexander Wilkie had created a spiritual crisis by not returning the pig. Mr. Wilkie's tiny blunder, forgetting to reciprocate a gift, threatened to usher in a new age in which custom was blocked. Anxieties intensified as all around them fellow Tannies forged meaningful roads with helpful foreign powers. Up on the mountain tops of Yochanan, isolated by geography and therefore off the itinerary of most political types, custom life continued in rhythms millennia old. At the same time, from this vantage point, men like Chief Neva and Duk Nowau could gaze down to the fray below and see two things happening. Their John Frum and Christian neighbours in more accessible areas were gaining obvious advantages as the lines were drawn for the newly independent state. At the same time, the more their fellow Tannies flirted with France and America and Britain, the more of their custom they lost. Prince Philip was their perfect solution. Battle standard, source of income, symbol, and personal friend. More important than the mythological angle was Philip's own attitude. On his first visit, he was unencumbered by his wife, Mrs. Queen, and accompanied by his favourite maternal uncle, Louis Mountbatten. For Philip, this was lads on tour with gold knobs on. Sometimes he wore a Hawaiian shirt, just like the bush boys do when they're living the high life in Port Vila. He swam in lagoons, rubbed noses with Tahitian lovelies, sat grinning on a plastic chair chalked with the word throne. Pictures of that time show a relaxed, happy man, someone deeply into the stuff he's seeing. The Pacific spoke to something within Philip, its respect for the sea, its manly values, its gruff, hearty, unpretentious ways. A whole cosmology flowed into and out of this perceived friendship. The older idea of black and white men as separated brothers, the mystical concept of a shattered cosmos, with people and continents split apart from their other halves. So, Philip, Duke of Edinburgh, and hence the overlord of Hebrides old and new, served a purpose both spiritual and political. As a man combining bronze and silver, tanner and England, black and white, he embodied the process they longed for. By seeking a road with him, they attracted further friendly white visitors, journalists, camera crews, tourists, government men, confirming the idea that Philip could unite people of different skins, maybe unite everything exiled from itself. Philippism was Jokinanen's way of defining and keeping a political identity in uncertain times. It had something none of their neighbour schemes had. A backer, both foreign and homegrown at the same time. It also had authenticity. Philip wasn't just alive and walking around in a way that Jesus and John Frum weren't. He sent letters and photographs to prove his mutual interest in the road. His cult also basked in the distinction of being utterly unlike Christianity, or John Frum, or any other movement that seemed to have failed. Without prayers or hymns or paraphernalia, it could be practiced secretly and constantly, in and through the daily business of living the traditional lifestyle. It had no symbols to attack, or burn down, or ban. Strangers and snoopers need not even know that Philippism was being practiced under their noses. By simply staying true to custom, you worshipped your god. The cult is so impeccably Tannese, so shot through with their turbulent history and their harmonious worldview, that it's easy to lose sight of its very European figurehead. But the people of Jokinanen never do. Letters continue to pass back and forth between Buckingham Palace and the Pacific. In 1980, as the newly founded government of Vanuatu tried to impose a head tax throughout the archipelago, the Philippists asked their patron prince to intercede. Philip wrote back, telling them to pay up. But for years afterwards, unable to read, Chief Jack waved the letter in the face of government men, convinced he had Buckingham Palace backing. Ever since then, newspaper articles have been collected, pored over, and preserved. Philip-related trivia, his date of birth, the names of his grandchildren, are treasured and swapped in those nakamals where his name is sacred. He was adopted for political reasons, perhaps, but his Tannese parents are no less interested in the real man. So what does Philip make of it? When I approached the palace with my own questions, I was answered, but any probings as to the prince's personal feelings drew a witheringly regal silence. The palace didn't have to send photographs and letters to encourage the islanders. It could so easily have turned into a PR disaster for the prince, been seen at best as a gesture with ill-conceived consequences, at worst as a faintly racist trick. He went along with it because, bearing in mind the mess being left behind by the hastily imploding empire, his diplomatic advisers in London and Port Vila argued that a friendly gesture was preferable to no gesture at all. And lastly, Prince Philip went along with it, probably, because he found it as amusing as we do. He has, at last, met men from Tanna. Just as Chief Jack predicted, after my return to England, I was a gate for a brief, partially televised union of worshippers and worshipped. I'd acted as advisor to a TV crew, bringing a group of custom people over to experience the British way of life, and as an extra treat, a meeting at Windsor had gone onto the itinerary. "How are your gardens?" was the black and white god's opening gambit to the Tannese delegation. Nobody fainted, and since the footage has been shown on Tanna, nobody has slaughtered all their pigs or thrown their money into the volcano. Prince Philip played the perfect royal host. Friendly, manly, slightly distant. He didn't give much away, nor did he make any of his famous faux pas about pot bellies or cannibals. My last glimpse of Nako was of him pressed like a little boy against the wire fence as the plane rose into the sky. It was an emblem for his life, I thought, hanging on, waiting for some personal takeoff at the edge of the runway, but never quite there. We levelled out over a sea the colour of paintings, and I wiped the dusty smudge where my watch used to be.
Philip Franks was reading the final extract from Man Belong, Mrs. Queen by Matthew Bayliss. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. Thank you. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday, the 4th of January. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Faroes. The general synopsis at 1800. Low West Faroe 956, expected 200 miles east of Iceland 970 by 1800 Saturday. New low expected southwest 40s 985 by same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours: Viking north at Sira, south at Sira. Southerly or southeasterly 6 to gale 8, decreasing 5 for a time. Rain or squally showers, good, occasionally poor. 40s, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne, Dogger. Southwest becoming cyclonic, 6 to gale 8, occasionally severe gale 9 at first in Dogger, decreasing 5 at times later. Rain or squally showers, good, occasionally poor. Fisher, German Bight. Southwest 6 to gale 8, occasionally severe gale 9 at first in German Bight, backing southeast 5 to 7, squally showers, rain later, good, occasionally poor. Humber, Thames, Dover, White. West or southwest, backing south for a time, 7 to severe gale 9, decreasing 5 or 6 for a time. Rain or squally thundery showers, good, occasionally poor. Portland, Plymouth, Biscay. South or southwest, veering west, 7 to severe gale 9, decreasing 5 or 6 for a time. Rain or squally thundery showers, moderate or poor. Trafalgar, westerly or southwesterly, 6 to gale 8, occasionally severe gale 9 in north, decreasing 5 at times in south. Squally showers, moderate.